The days after August 4th came mostly in a blur. There was obviously the anger and the questions, but also just disbelief. People were still checking up on each other. Even those who had escaped with no serious injuries couldn't say they were completely okay. When asked, "How are you?" people would respond by saying, "Physically, I'm fine." The day after the blast, Beirut Governor Marwan Aboud was one of the first officials to visit the scene. He stood in the remnants of the port and cried. The death toll was rising quickly past 100, and even at this point, the situation was bleak. Over 6,500 wounded, at least, and over 250,000 people homeless. Officials estimated half the buildings in the capital were damaged, and the financial cost of reconstruction would run to the billions. At an emergency cabinet session the next day, President Michel Aoun said the horror was indescribable and vowed an investigation to bring those responsible to account. But on the streets outside the port, the state felt absent. It was ordinary people who started gathering to clear rubble, search for survivors, and collect donations for those in need. 2 days after the explosion, the president visited the port and went up through the neighborhood just above the docks, an area called Mamakhail, and over into Jemese. There he was confronted by angry residents. "How could they let this happen?" they demanded. He held one woman as she cried. But this wasn't Lebanon's President Michel Aoun. This was Emmanuel Macron, the President of France, who arrived in the wake of the devastation. He was the first senior politician to face the public on the streets. The crying woman asked why he was sitting with the politicians, who she called warlords. "I'm not here to help them," he replied. "I'm here to help you." He promised to coordinate international aid and told the people of Lebanon that he would be having frank conversations with the politicians. But then, Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned. Nothing could be done until the parties agreed a new administration. Then, politicians said, they would get right to the necessary reforms. A year later, there's no new government, no political reforms. The investigation into the blast is ongoing. The economy has got much, much worse. Over half the Lebanese people are now living below the poverty line. This is The Blast from Beyond the Headlines. I'm Finbar Anderson. If you haven't heard the whole series, go back now and subscribe to Beyond the Headlines. In this final episode, we're looking at the fallout from the August 4th explosion. But first, we're going back to Beirut in the hours and days immediately after, back to the dust, the broken glass and the confusion. Rena Ranem and her fiancé, Wael Abifecher, came out of the explosion without any serious injuries. In the anxious hours of waiting for updates, they did the only thing they could think of. They cleaned, not their apartments, but the streets of Beirut.
You know, we just grabbed whatever brooms and shovels and things we had. But the weird thing is we just didn't know where to start because it was just so much.
It was everywhere
that eventually we just had to stop and then just start somewhere. It was so massively just destroyed that you just didn't know if you were actually doing something. But then eventually started seeing other people working along and then everyone kind of just, you know, worked together.
The Jemese and Mamakhail neighborhoods were some of the worst hit. These are the streets where Wael and Rena met, where they started dating. These are the streets with their favorite bars and cafes. And it was all destroyed.
It was hard to clean when you were just sitting there, like, just heartbroken for the place that you spent most of your time. And we know, like, all the bar owners and all the people that work down there and everyone who goes down there. And it was just like, you couldn't even think of cleaning because you're just consoling everybody and being consoled what was destroyed.
It was, a lot to process, just seeing blood everywhere.
August 4th was a dark day for Beirut, but if there was anything that could shine a ray of light, it was the sense of community. This country that is so often talked about as divided by sects, parties, classes, and nationalities, everyone came together to help.
And that was very touching to hear some people that I had encountered in Bekaa, who were refugees, and others that were stateless, even decided to rally up the troops, and they came down in buses to Beirut to help with the cleanup. And it was just the insurmountable amount of love from younger generations, from older generations.
Just an entire community coming together, basically.
The feeling of people coming together was incredibly powerful. But Rena says she still felt abandoned. Throughout the cleanup operation, the government was nowhere to be seen. Down at the port, Rom El Nohra, who worked in the now shattered grain silos, was with his surviving colleagues looking for people trapped under the rubble.
It took us almost a month to find all of our colleagues. 18 days, not a month, 18 days. Not every day, we were taking turns. We were taking turns there.
A year on from the blast, there are still major questions to be answered. First, what lit the spark? So we don't know exactly what caused the fire at Warehouse 12 on August 4th. There's several reports and claims, and some are more likely than others. One claim made repeatedly is that it was caused by an airstrike. Some even claim neighboring Israel carried out an attack. Israel has denied this, but given the countries are still technically at war, people are suspicious. One of the things behind this claim is the almost jet-like roar that could be heard in the moments before the explosion. But other than that, there's no evidence to support this claim. There are dozens and dozens of videos from all over the city of the moments of the blast. None show any sign of an aircraft or missile strike, except a few that can easily be debunked as doctored. Then there's the semi-official account. This is one put out by officials as a working theory. That day, workers were repairing the doors of Warehouse 12, and in the process of welding the metal, they started a fire that spread through the warehouse. The owner of the company behind the welding, Salim Shibli, is currently in pretrial detention. But my colleague Suniva, who has been covering this story since the day it happened, spoke to his sister Gita a couple of weeks ago. She confirmed that there were three welders working on Warehouse 12 on August 4th, but that they never went inside because they had no keys to get in. If you remember from episode 2, there are two locks on the doors of the warehouse. One is held by the customs authority and the other is held by the port authority. Both are needed to get inside. She insisted they used a 15-amp battery-operated machine for the welding that causes no sparks. She added that the welders left the site at 3:45 p.m., over an hour before the fire was first reported. Gita thinks it's just not possible the welding caused a fire because the work was so minor and it was outside the building. The final answer on that, though, will have to wait for the results of the official investigation. And there is an official investigation. In episode 2, we heard from officials at the port who knew about the ammonium nitrate. But it wasn't just them. Even the president and the prime minister knew. Here's what we know about the investigation itself. The August 4th blast was a national crisis, and as such was brought to the Higher Judicial Council. They're effectively the country's top 10 judges. This court is a little different from the usual. The judgments are final, and it's not possible to appeal the verdict. Judge Ferdi Sawen was initially assigned to lead the probe and build a case. The aims, while crucial, are the basics. Was the explosion caused by negligence, an accident, or a deliberate act, like a bombing? And if there is culpability, to hold those responsible to account. Judge Sawen cast a wide net and 25 officials were detained in September 2020, from low-level employees all the way up to the port's general manager, Hassan Oretem, and the former director general of Lebanon's customs, Shafi Mirei. The harbour master and security officers were also detained. And here's where it starts to get complicated. In December 2020, he charged caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab and three former ministers with criminal negligence. But all four refused to be questioned, citing immunity. These charges sparked a backlash from politicians, and Judge Sawan was removed from the case, much to the anger of the victims' families. The same officials who promised a thorough investigation, saying no one was above the law, allowed the investigating judge to be dismissed as soon as he implicated politicians. The case was picked up by a judge called Tariq Bitar, who carried on much in the same vein. Parliament is still fiercely debating the issue of ministers' immunity, but activists and the families have basically accused politicians of promising justice while trying to slow the case down. Lebanon is a deeply sectarian country. Sectarianism was one of the drivers of the civil war, and it still impacts politics today. The president will always be a Maronite, the speaker a Shiite, and the prime minister a Sunni. This is the same for official positions. The Port Authority Board is appointed based on representing the main sex, and there are 18 recognized sects. This, many of the people we spoke to for this series feel, has a direct impact on the causes of the blast and the investigation. Reda Fangie is a Lebanese lawyer and researcher working with NGO Legal Agenda, and she says that sectarianism makes it impossible to hold those responsible accountable.
If you attack any person who's holding office, you are not holding, the regime's view is that you're not holding this person accountable because they're holding public office, but you're attacking the sect or the political group to which it belongs. And this is mainly what has blocked all forms of accountability possible for years.
As part of the investigation, Lebanese authorities say they issued arrest warrants to Interpol, the international policing network. Two of the names on these warrants were for Russian nationals Boris Prokoshev and Igor Gretchushkin, the captain of the Rosas and its owner. The third, Lebanese state media said, was for a Portuguese trader who examined the ammonium nitrate in Warehouse 12 in 2014. Despite being reported by Lebanese state media, we searched Interpol's Red Notice database, but couldn't find these names on the list. Boris says he warned officials about the dangerous cargo of the Rosas, and he isn't responsible for it being there, staying there, or the explosion. But, he says, the Interpol Red Notice has put his life on hold. He's no longer able to sail.
No, Russia doesn't extradite their citizens for Interpol. But if I leave the country, they'll send me to Beirut. Well, what can I say? It's terrible. I feel like my life is already coming to its end. It's not real life. It's just a survival.
My colleague Saniva Rose, who joined me on previous episodes, has spoken to those close to the investigation, but direct external contact with the judges investigating is forbidden. 1 year on, there are no official findings and no trials have been held. There have been some outside investigations too. News agency Reuters claimed to have seen an FBI report that says not all of the ammonium nitrate exploded. In fact, it claimed only 552 tons had detonated. But if that's true, then what happened to the other 2,198 tons? One port worker we spoke to claimed he had a bag of it at his house that he uses to fertilize his garden. Of course, it is possible that only some of the ammonium nitrate exploded. Back in episode 2, we went down to the port to try and piece together who does what. Here's a quick recap. We have the port authority that manages the facility. You have the harbour master who directs maritime traffic. The customs authority that checks goods coming in and out of Lebanon for tax and contraband. You have general security, the army, and state security that all deal with, well, security. Saniva and I met with Christian Chard, who has been on the Port Authority Board since 2002. Let's go back there now, sitting in the big boardroom of the Port Authority with its new windows overlooking the devastated port.
Our role is to take decisions for the development of the port, but we don't have anything to do with the day-to-day management of the port. So we were not aware, and we are not aware of what happened.
Shar told us that the port authority did unload the Rosas and move the cargo to Warehouse 12 where the fire was, but he says they did that under the direction of customs. We asked Shar if the port authority should have done more.
What kind of due diligence can we do? Everybody was saying these goods are dangerous.
Go on the media, say in public, in TV, and say there's something that's going to explode in the port. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Raise public opinion.
There was plenty of correspondence from officers, from people, maybe the customs, etc., and writing to each other. It reached the presidency and the prime minister a few weeks before the blast.
Yes, but you're well aware that it was 7 years of correspondence that went nowhere.
Okay, what can we do? Can we chase the army? Can we chase the customs? We here at the port, we are under the authority of all these organizations.
One of the things that you do have responsibility for as a port, as you've told us several times, is for the development of the port. Why hasn't there been a place built for properly storing explosive materials?
There was this hangar dedicated to dangerous materials. And probably the port said, okay, now they've put it in the hangar, it's going to be... They're going to clear all these goods and dispose them off or sell them or whatever. And you know, years have passed. They didn't, there was no signs of immediate danger, etc.
If you're going to develop the port, surely you need to develop infrastructure, facilities with maybe...
As you say, 20 tons in Jordan, as you well, you said that's how they do it there. Like,
why
didn't you just
sprinklers
say,
maybe?
Yes,
for the fireworks.
We were aware of this after the blast.
But for example, installing fireworks, sprinklers, something, safety mechanisms in a hangar storing dangerous goods, why was that not installed?
Hello, maybe I'm not denying any responsibility to the port, of course. But before the port being taken responsible for this, you have to address the legal, the judge, the customs.
Of course, and
we
are speaking to all of those.
We are at the end of the responsibility.
Officials from the customs authority, state security and general security had sounded the alarm over the storage of the ammonium nitrate. We've seen reports and court records asking for it to be removed. We've seen a letter to the military asking if they could take it. But time and again, this came down to process. Who actually had custody of the nitrate and who had the authority to move it?
The customs officials are not security agents.
They are not security agents, and they don't have the material and the human resource to do anything about it.
That's George Khoury, the lawyer for customs head Badri Deher, who has been in custody since the blast.
Before the explosion, if you are an employee in the government, you have to respect, you have to report to your higher officer, who is Minister of Finance. If he tell you do, go to the judge and try to bring a decision from him. You have to do this. You cannot go and bring trucks and take the, it's not like, because of the explosion,
because of the explosion, some people said, why you didn't? Why you didn't? But you can't move goods that have been placed by a judge under legal guardianship, and you need to respect the decision of the minister.
Again, Khoury simply says they sounded the alarm, but they had no authority to do anything about it. The judge investigating the case has the authority to detain people indefinitely. Badri Deher is one of those, so too is his predecessor Shafiq Mirey. And so, Deher and Mirey share a room in prison. There's no AC, and Khoury says it's sweltering in the summer. There's no TV, but they are allowed books to pass the time, and they get a walk outside once a day. Another is Harbourmaster Mohammed Al-Mola. His family, like Deher's lawyer and many of the others, insist he is innocent, a victim of a poor system. When we were at the port to visit the site of the ruined silos, we ran into a protest by Mola's family.
Okay, so we've just come outside the general security offices. And there's tons of people outside here.
He was arrested 1 month after the explosion, and how do we say this? His responsibility is from the harbor, on going to the water.
Okay.
He has nothing on him. All of his papers show that he is someone who is, how do we say that? He's innocent. He has nothing to do with the whole thing, and he's still detained until now. So we hope that, you know, the justice will take place for him. And we're still waiting, and we have faith in the justice system that's going to take place, but we're still waiting. It's been 10 months.
Roger Sayyir is a Lloyd's agent in Beirut. Lloyd's is one of the biggest insurers in the world and has a long history of maritime insurance. He works with shipping firms in the port and sees the operation close up. Sayyir says a culture of unaccountability is the root cause of why the ammonium nitrate sat at the port for 6 years while everyone from the top to the bottom warned that action was needed.
You might have a decree that says one thing and on the ground a different reality or a slightly altered version of that reality and no one taking responsibility. And that just compounds with the issue of murky jurisdiction. Who is it that has the right, in this case, to, let's say, auction this cargo that's been detained? Unclear. Did anyone attempt to? Unclear. There's back and forth between various authorities of what to do with the cargo. Goes all the way to the top, and they say, do the necessary. Goes back down to the bottom, and said, oh, we don't have the jurisdiction. Here, you do it. So they keep passing the buck. Back and forth. Everyone wanting the ability and authority to do the cargo as they please, which in that circumstance would have been ideally to auction it, to raise funds for the Lebanese treasury, allegedly. But none of that was done because there is no clear-cut authorization or jurisdiction.
This account is borne out in what we uncovered, if you remember from episode 2. The port authority knew the ammonium nitrate was there, helped unload it, but was not in charge of storage. The customs knew it was there, were asked to facilitate the transport to Warehouse 12, but say it was not theirs to look after. The army knew it was there, the transport ministry, even the president of the whole country said after the blast that he knew it was there and dangerous, but he said that he had no jurisdiction over the workings of the port, so he could not take any action.
And of course, the complete absence of any sort of oversight on any of the authorities. So it leads to a murky little swamp that is impossible to determine the correct course of action, what was done, what should have been done, who did it, who's responsible, who isn't, and we end up a year later with nothing. Two judges swapped out as head of the investigation, and nothing really, we didn't get anywhere, and that is the essence.
Even a year on, the total number of people who died in the Beirut blast has been difficult to verify. The Health Ministry published two lists following the explosion, one just days after the blast on August 7th, and another a month later on September 3rd. The last list contains 191 names, including one unknown Bangladeshi man and one unknown Filipino woman. In the following months, different numbers were published in the media and by international NGOs that ranged from 207 to 214. Suniva was determined to get to the bottom of it. She contacted the Prime Minister's office and the Health Ministry to get a final number several times, but did not receive a response. She tried the police, known as the Internal Security Forces. The ISF was reluctant at first, but finally they shared their full list of names. The list is not public, and they urged us not to publish it to protect the privacy of the victims' families. But there's also a snag. This isn't actually the official list. The ISF said that they believed it was the Health Ministry who should make the definitive list of victims public. This was just their tally. Suniva compared the ISF's list with one compiled by a local NGO called MAN, who say they contacted the family of every single victim to verify their account and published a book in June with short biographies of all those who lost their lives. Now, there are discrepancies between the police list and the MAN list. MAN lists 218 names and the police 214, but not all of the names match. Some of these discrepancies we could explain. For example, on MAN's list were 9 children, while the ISF registered 8 children killed. The 3 Lebanese, 3 Syrians, 1 Australian and 1 Pakistani child who died matched on the 2 lists. But MAN registered an extra Syrian child who was only 6 months old when he died on August 4th. The child's mother told MAN that her baby died in a pediatric hospital when it was destroyed by the explosion. But when Suniva spoke to the doctor of the little boy, he said that the child would have died on August 4th regardless of whether the hospital had been destroyed or not. He said he was born with a severe liver disease and would not have lived. Was this child then a victim of the August 4th blast or not? Difficult calls like this may account for some of the differences between the police list and the NGOs. But if MAN confirmed its list with each of the families and all the police list names are also verified, that means as many as 229 people could have died on August 4, 2020. We have as yet been unable to track down all the names on both lists to corroborate. So, what do those caught up in the blast actually want to happen? Maybe it's cliche to say that no jail sentence or punishment could bring back lost loved ones, undo the sleepless nights of worry, or ease the tension many who lived through that day still carry with them. Sarah Copland, who was working for the UN in Beirut, lost her 2-year-old son, Isaac. A large shard of glass blown out by the blast hit him right in the chest. She shared her story in the last episode, but we also asked her what she thinks justice looks like.
Whole issue for me, it's more that the principle of the matter, that people are recognizing that what happened was wrong, that people are responsible, and we can't just let a city be blown to smithereens and the world moves on. You know, there needs to be people to say that what happened to Isaac and what happened to all of the other people who were killed and injured and who lost their homes and their businesses, that was wrong. And I think one of the huge issues is it is those in authority, right up until the president, who knew that the ammonium nitrate was there. And how can we ask them, expect them to hold themselves accountable when they haven't done so in the past? Of course, in an ideal world, I would love the Lebanese investigation to be successful, but I don't have faith in that. And so that's why I've started working with Legal Action Worldwide and Human Rights Watch in pushing for a Human Rights Council resolution into an independent fact-finding mission.
But Rita Frangier from Legal Agenda says the local investigation must succeed if the country is to change.
It's definitely a lot of pressure on one person. It's a lot of pressure, but it's also a very important milestone in our history. If we can get through this, you're talking about a huge change in the form of our regime. This post-war regime that's been here for 3 decades. The blast case and the investigation that is taking place now is what's going to determine the future of this regime, in my opinion. It's going to decide whether we're going to continue in the cycle of impunity or whether we're going to break it or not. And I think we lost a chance. And I hope we will not lose this chance now.
Ibtissam, the wife of port silo worker Ghassan Hashrouti, is still furious, and she's heartbroken at losing her husband.
I want to be living alongside him now. I want to be with him now. Okay, we grew up together and we had our kids, but now, in this time, I want to be with him. Imagine you want to say something to your husband. Would you say it to anyone else? You wouldn't say it to your daughter or son. You can't say it to anyone else.
She doesn't hold out much hope for the investigation.
There must be justice. People must be hung from the gallows. There must be some accountability. Because without it, there's no justice. There's nothing.
On a purely personal level, I'm angry. I'm angry because I spent weeks pulling shards of glass out of my body. But the lasting wounds are under the skin. My mental health has not been the same after the blast. A couple of months after the blast, I remember being woken up by the first thunderstorm of the winter. In that semi-conscious state, I was convinced the city was blowing up again and my windows would once again explode into a million tiny deadly shards. There's a lot of anger still in Lebanon, and it's deeper than just the blast. In October 2019, there were huge nationwide protests, pretty much without historical precedent. That sectarianism that's so deeply rooted in the politics didn't stop people of all communities taking to the streets. They demanded the end of corruption, nepotism, ineffectual governance, action to tackle the economic crisis, and a new Lebanon. Chants like Killun Yani Killun, or All of Them Means All of Them, were heard. But despite those massive, unprecedented protests, very little actually happened. The Prime Minister at the time resigned, but he was brought back again just a few weeks after the blast and tasked to form a new government. When he failed, after almost a year of negotiations with the various political parties, a new prime minister designate was chosen, a billionaire who's been PM several times before. Rina told me that for her, the blast, an explosion that destroyed half of the city she calls home, killed any hope that she would see any meaningful change in her lifetime.
It's just This entire day that will haunt us for the rest of our lives. It's a perfect example of this political structure that is in place where even people's death, even people's mass losses, displacement, won't even move them. They don't care. It's not even something that triggers anything in them. It's something so minute, so insignificant. And they're still here. And they still have the audacity to show up on TV or in interviews and to say and to claim that they were not responsible. That this entire situation, be it the explosion, be it the economic crisis, being the fact that people can't get gas or water or diapers, is not their responsibility. The death of people was not able to make them empathetic. What will? It really makes you think, what will if this didn't trigger that emotion?
Something changed on the 4th of August, 2020. Rena Ghanem, like thousands of others, is still haunted by memories of that summer evening and its aftermath. She and her husband Wael recently went back to Mama Khail, the area they had helped clear the rubble from.
And I couldn't help but remember, literally, because the amount of blood down that street was just immeasurable. It was everywhere. And I was literally looking down. There's no more glass, no more rubble, no more blood. But it was still there somehow. I don't know if that makes sense.
Rena realized she was going to have to do something that had always been unthinkable. She was going to leave Lebanon.
It was definitely a breaking moment in every sense of the way. I had never wanted to leave, not because this was a great place to live. We've always had problems politically, socially, economically. It was never the best or safest place to live. But comparatively, it was a good place. It was a place where I had built a life, a community, where I had work opportunities because I work within the humanitarian field. And it was a place, I think, for me, most importantly, that still had hope for betterment, for improvement. And on August 4, 2020, that hope died.
Rena and Wael will be the first to tell you that they're the lucky ones. They're able to leave. For millions of others, that's not an option. Those who are left behind are living through one of the worst financial crises in modern history. With no money to fix them, many of the buildings destroyed in the port explosion remain empty and broken. And in the year since the explosion, Lebanon has been without a government, as politicians haggle over who gets what portfolio and the reforms demanded by the international community and by so many of the Lebanese people go ignored. This was The Blast from Beyond the Headlines. Thanks to all of those who took the time to speak to us to make this series, to those who shared their stories, to those who carefully walked us through the intricacies of what has happened. You can find out more about The Blast and all our coverage from Beirut and beyond at thenationalnews.com. I've been your host, Finbar Anderson. We were produced by Suniva Rose, Aisha Khan, and Arthur Edison, with assistance from Wajid Al-Khamis. Additional reporting and fact-checking came from Suniva Rose. Voiceovers were read by Juman Jurallah, Bohdan Bondarov, and Ahmed Maher. The series' executive producers were James Hayes-Young and Erica El-Khershi.